It's Thursday, August 20th, 2026, and this is Pip Install, your daily download on power, security and the machines. Last night the President announced what he called an economic D-Day against Iran, threatening consequences for any country, anywhere, that gives Tehran a financial lifeline. There is one problem with it, and we'll get to it. Nothing was actually signed. Meanwhile, Iran's own central banker went on television and admitted something rather larger. Then we widen out today. Russia battered Kiev overnight, China is quietly playing its chips, and North Korea fired 10 missiles after Washington cut an exercise short. And a midterms update, where the sleeper issue of this election turns out to be data centres. Let's install today's update. Start with the declaration. Freya.
It landed just before 8 last night, on his own platform, in capitals. The most crushing economic operation ever taken against any country. His phrase, this will be an economic D-Day. And the threat is aimed past Iran, at everybody else. Any country that allows its financial institutions, businesses, airports, or government entities to provide any type of lifeline to Iran will itself face tremendous economic consequences. He listed targets: oil smuggling, swap lines, cash transfers, exchange houses, ship registries, front companies. It all needs to stop now. Now the honesty notes, because they matter more than usual. That was a social media post. There's no tape. We're reading it to you. No country was named. No mechanism was given. And as of this morning, no executive order has been signed. Nothing has appeared in the Federal Register, and no new sanctions designations have been issued. 3.5 hours before he posted it, the president said on camera, "We have things that we could sanction. We have very draconian sanctions, and we'll see what happens."
Stack, so what's actually happening to Iran's economy, if not that?
Something far more consequential, and it came from Abu Dhabi rather than Washington, a day earlier. On Tuesday evening, the United Arab Emirates suspended all trade, all commercial exchange, and all financial transactions with Iran. Analysts at the Institute for the Study of War assess that single move takes out roughly a third of Iran's imports and about 80% of its foreign exchange flow. A retired American general told Al Jazeera, "The Emirati embargo is even more significant than the embargo being put on by the United States," and said Tehran may read it as bordering on an act of war. So mind the sequence. The actual damage was done Tuesday by a Gulf neighbour, and the American announcement followed a day later with no instrument attached. And here is the hardest fact of the night, which almost nobody led with. Iran's central bank governor, Abdelnaser Hemati, went on Iranian state television and said the country's oil revenue has fallen to zero. His words, "It is a reality that we are not exporting oil." He added that none of Iran's frozen funds abroad have been released. That's the governor of the central bank on state media, conceding the core of his own country's economy has stopped. Exports are down 94% in a fortnight. When your adversary's own banker says that out loud, you don't need a D-Day.
And the street itself. Freya, there's one number today that tells the whole story.
There is, and it's remarkable. Al Jazeera tracked every ship through Hormuz for the first 19 days of this month. 236 vessels. Of those, 83 openly used the Iranian route, 3 used the American-backed Omani one, and 148 simply went dark, switching off their transponders. Read that again. More ships are openly defying Washington than are defying Tehran. A shipping analyst at Capler put the other half of it. It increasingly looks like Iran has at least partially lost control of the strait. So neither side really commands that water. The traffic is just hiding from both of them. Throughput is disputed too. somewhere around 13 ships a day against more than 100 before the war, and roughly 5 million barrels moving where 15 million used to.
Bash.
I keep catching on the phrase economic D-Day. D-Day was a morning in which something like 4,500 Allied soldiers died in a matter of hours to begin taking a continent back. Reaching for, to name, a sanctions package that hasn't been signed is the kind of thing that sounds enormous in a post and means very little by lunchtime. And it does cost something. Every time that word gets spent on a press release, it's worth a little less to the people who might one day need it to mean what it actually meant. The squeeze underneath is real, though, and worth being precise about who feels it. Iranian inflation is running near 66%. Food is up over 120%. The central bank has just admitted the oil money is gone. That lands on shopkeepers and pensioners in Tabriz long before it troubles anyone making decisions in Tehran. And it's landing here too. Diesel in this country has roughly doubled since January, and last week was the most expensive August at the pump ever recorded. Both of those are the same war, arriving in two different currencies.
So, a declaration with nothing signed. An Emirati embargo that did the real damage a day earlier. A central banker admitting the oil money is gone, and Brent near 94 for a fifth straight day. Now, we spend a lot of nights inside this one war, so let's lift our heads. Russia, China, Korea. Freya, start in Kiev.
Because it was a brutal night there. Russia hit Ukraine with a mass missile and drone barrage overnight. At least a dozen people killed. And the toll still climbing as we record. More than 30 wounded. Something like 28 separate sites struck. Two police officers were killed at a station in Zhytomyr. And the detail that ties it straight back to our lead. Zelensky spent yesterday pleading for Patriot interceptors, because Ukraine's air defences are running dry. Those are the same interceptors America has been firing over the Gulf. We gave you the number a fortnight ago. US Patriot stocks down around 65% from pre-war levels, against a production line that takes roughly 3.5 years per missile.
Which is the strategic story of this month in one sentence. There is one stockpile and three theatres. Every interceptor fired over Hormuz is one not standing over Poland or Taipei. Not a moral argument, an arithmetic one. Last night, Kiev is where the arithmetic showed up. One footnote worth noticing, Russia said nothing at all about the economic D-Day. No Lavrov, no Peskov, no foreign ministry line, not even in their own state wire. When Moscow declines to comment on Washington threatening the world's banks, that silence is information. Now China, playing this with some skill, two moves, opposite directions. First, chips. Beijing quietly eased its own block and let the first NVIDIA H200s in, roughly 10,000 each to ByteDance and Tencent. Correct the framing you'll see everywhere. This is not Washington relenting. Washington had already approved up to 100,000 each. It was Beijing holding them out to protect its own chipmakers, and most must stay in Hong Kong, which hasn't the power to run them. Exactly enough to keep its champions in the race, and not one chip more. Second, the other way. Nikkei reports Beijing slowing exports of germanium, quartz, and specialist magnets to Taiwan. Feedstock for optics, aerospace, ultimately chip-making. Single-sourced on unnamed people, so hold it lightly. But if it's real, it's the same lever aimed at Taipei that Washington aims at Beijing. And Beijing's line on the D-Day was cool to the point of dismissive. Imposing sanctions and pressuring do not help to solve the issue, while conspicuously not promising to stop buying Iranian oil.
And Korea, which moved fast and badly this week.
Trump ordered the annual joint exercise with South Korea cut from 11 days to 5. It ends tomorrow, saying the drills were very insulting to Kim Jong-un. North Korea then fired around 10 short-range ballistic missiles overnight. A bipartisan group of senators has written asking him to reverse it. And Seoul found out the way everyone finds out now. Their foreign minister said plainly, "Neither our government nor US officials knew what President Trump wrote on his Truth Social. We were not notified in advance." The backdrop is that South Korea declined to join the Iran operation. And the president said of that, "We have 39,000 soldiers over there, guarding you from Kim Jong-un. And you're not going to help us on a very easy military operation in Iran? That's strange."
Put those three together and name what they share, because it isn't strength. A superpower with one set of magazines is being asked to cover Ukraine, the Gulf, and the Pacific at once. And this week, it visibly could not. Kyiv asked for interceptors we've been firing somewhere else. The carrier that would sit off Asia is sailing to the Gulf, which means, as of now, there is no American carrier in the Western Pacific. And into that, allies get handed a loyalty questionnaire, which is a thing you send when you're worried about your friends rather than your enemies. A dozen people died in Kyiv last night waiting for air defense that exists and is somewhere else. That isn't a policy disagreement. That's just what finite looks like once you've spent a long time pretending it wasn't.
One stockpile, three theaters, and the bell arriving in all of them at once. A midterms update now, and the surprise is what's driving it, not the war. Data centers. Stack.
And the numbers are startling. A poll out yesterday finds 75% of Americans now oppose a data center being built near their home. A year ago, that was split, 43% in favor, 42% against. That's a 33-point swing in 12 months. Strongly support has collapsed from 13% to 4%. And it isn't partisan, which is exactly what makes it lethal for incumbents. Opposition runs 43 points underwater with Republicans, 65 with independents, 63 with rural voters. That's one commissioned poll, single-sourced, weigh it accordingly. But it matches Fox News polling out of Ohio earlier this summer. Which brings us to the leak. A National Republican Senatorial Committee memo warns that data center backlash could cost the party a Senate seat in Ohio, where Senator John Husted is tied to some 200 of them. His Democratic opponent went at it on camera. Husted has been the front guy on all these data centers, getting huge over-the-top tax breaks and raising utility rates. And the irony is almost too neat. Husted is a sponsor of the Senate bill meant to protect ratepayers from data centers.
And beneath the polling, towns are simply acting. In a single day, Indianapolis locked in a moratorium through the end of next year, unanimously. Virginia Beach passed a one-year ban. So did Harpersville, Alabama, Angels Camp, California, Ottawa, Illinois, a county in Oregon, a town in Wisconsin. Memphis is weighing one, in the city that hosts Elon Musk's XAI. Texas legislators spent Wednesday interrogating data center developers directly over water and power. And Reuters reports record midterm spending from crypto, AI, and betting firms, calling them the new kingmakers. So the industry is buying in at precisely the moment the electorate turns on it. And the war is on that ballot too. Reuters and Ipsos, polling taken last week, so not fresh, but worth the number, put the president's approval at 33%, the lowest of his presidency. Only 20% of Americans say this war has been worth it. 80% expect it to drag on.
And the race that already voted ran on exactly that. Here is the woman who won Tuesday's primary in Alaska, Mary Peltola, on election night.
We are getting crushed by corporate greed. Dan Sullivan, every single vote, votes along with corporate greed. He is there for every fat cat in the nation, from healthcare to fuel to groceries.
And she didn't merely advance out of that primary. She finished first, 48% to Senator Dan Sullivan's 43, with 98% counted. About 25,000 absentees are still out. and the fourth and final slot is currently separated by 23 votes. But the story that should travel is what the federal government is doing about it. There was a second man named Dan Sullivan on that ballot, Daniel J. Sullivan, Jr., a retired schoolteacher from Petersburg, ruled eligible by Alaska's own Supreme Court. He took 2.5%, nowhere near the 5-point gap. He decided nothing. And the Justice Department has convened a grand jury and issued subpoenas over his candidacy after the president publicly attacked him. He says he hasn't even been served. Election law scholars are blunt. One of the most prominent in the country said, "I don't see how the government could criminalize his running for office for having impure motives," and called it a very strong First Amendment defense.
A man ran for office under the name on his birth certificate. A court confirmed he was allowed to, and the federal government convened a grand jury about it. I want to be careful, because grand juries look at things all the time, and most of it goes nowhere. This will very likely go nowhere, but that's rather the point. The cost was never the conviction. The cost is that a retired teacher in a town of a few thousand now needs a lawyer he hasn't budgeted for, and every other person in this country who was thinking of putting their name on a ballot against someone powerful just watched what it got him. You don't have to win the case for the lesson to land. That's the whole mechanism.
75% opposed, a leaked memo, 33% approval, and a grand jury in Petersburg with 11 weeks to go. 2 clocks before the stars, stack, then bash.
Tomorrow the ballroom pause runs out. The Supreme Court holds the president's emergency application over the $400 million East Wing project. The government's final brief landed Wednesday, so it's fully briefed and no ruling has come. The appeals court stay expires Friday. 2 corrections, because outlets got both wrong. There was no oral argument. This is entirely on paper. And what's blocked is narrower than all construction, ENSIA. It's above ground work, expanding the ballroom's size and scale, while below ground security work continues. The appeals court majority wrote, "Whether or not a massive ballroom should be constructed is for Congress to decide and is not a matter for executive self-help." The dissenting judge called the injunction a blatant abuse of discretion. Meanwhile, the Times reports construction has gone to 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, while everyone waits.
And the other clock ran out on Tuesday, and nothing happened at all. The Pentagon owed Congress its records on how it counted the American dead in this war. As of this morning, no documents, no response, no refusal, no request for more time, and no follow-up from anyone. Because there's nobody in the building to follow up. One thing did move, quietly. The Pentagon's public tally went back up. 18 dead, 757 wounded, after having earlier been revised down. That's a single outlet reporting it, so hold it loosely. But take the two together and you have the shape of the thing. The number corrected itself and the paperwork explaining why never arrived. Congress doesn't return until the middle of September. Whoever moved that number the first time now knows exactly how long the gap is.
And finally, after D-Days and grand juries, Heap has a shrew. Heap.
I have, and it is doing something genuinely deranged with its own head. So, shrews. Tiny, frantic, have to eat almost constantly or die. And they've got this famous trick. Every winter, a shrew shrinks its own skull. Genuinely shrinks it, the brain case flattens and the brain gets smaller. Because a smaller brain burns fewer calories and there's less food about. Come spring, it grows back. It's called Dennell's phenomenon, and it is one of the strangest things any mammal does. But researchers have just found the bit everybody missed for a century. While the brain case is shrinking, the nose is getting bigger. The snout swells about 7% and widens by 6%. And the best guess is that it's a radiator. A bigger nose warms the freezing air on the way in, so the animal isn't burning precious energy heating its own breath. Shrink the expensive bit, grow the useful bit. And here's my favourite part. They worked it out from 136 shrew skulls, collected in Hokkaido between 1948 and 1988, which then sat in a botanical garden collection for decades, until somebody finally thought to go and measure the noses. Somebody in post-war Japan carefully labelled a very small skull, and 70-odd years later, it answered a question nobody had thought to ask yet. Which is the entire argument for keeping things. You never do know which drawer the answer's in.
An economic D-Day, with nothing signed and a central banker admitting the money's gone. One stockpile stretched across three wars. A grand jury for a man who ran under his own name. And a shrew that shrinks its skull and grows its nose to get through the winter. Hold all of it. That's the job. That's your install for Thursday, August 20th. Watch the ballroom deadline tomorrow. Watch whether the Pentagon ever sends a single page. And watch the phrase data center turn up in a campaign ad near you. The analysis is Anna Dudley's. I just handed you the update. I'm Pip. Package install success. We'll see you on the next install.